It was easy to find a family looking for a baby. I started to show, so I quit my job at the hospital even though I had just finished my residency. It would have been too much to explain why Campbell and I, who did want children, couldn't keep this child. To answer questions, to pretend to be joyful, to talk about a life I would never know. I hid in our loft. Campbell brought me screeners. I realized movies had gotten much worse since I started medical school. When she was in town, Melinda spent hours with me, trying to get me to talk, regaling me with stories of this or that event, the latest gossip from the set of her film, and how things were going with her co-star, a man she described as violently committed to dullness. My stomach swelled. The baby was active, always swimming around, kicking me, tearing my heart apart. Early on, I told Campbell I would move out until the baby was born. He did not appreciate the gesture. Refused. He tried to reach me, but I kept him out. We were living together, but we weren't. I refused to look at myself in mirrors. My body was the worst kind of prison, utterly inescapable. One day, toward the end, Campbell found me in the study, holding my belly, talking softly. It was the first time I really touched the baby. "Look at you," he said. "You're beautiful." I quickly let my arms fall to the side. "This doesn't mean anything." I shuffled out of the room as quickly as I could, leaving him stammering in my wake. Melinda was the only person I allowed in the delivery room. Campbell was furious, but I told him I wanted him in the delivery room when I gave birth to our child. I wanted to save that moment for him. My best friend held my hand and pressed cold cloths to my forehead. She did not fill the air with useless chatter. There are no words to describe how it feels to push a baby out of your body. Before the kidnapping, I would have thought it was the most inconceivable pain a woman can experience, but I knew better. When you give birth, you willingly break yourself. You allow your body to come apart. Each time I pushed, even though I was so miserable and exhausted, I held on to the promise of soon being free. I needed to rid myself of the terrible thing inside me. The nurse who laid the slick, squealing child on my chest didn't realize I had written in my birth plan that I didn't want to look upon him. I forced myself to look at him. His head was covered with a sticky mat of dark hair. His arms were so skinny, but his hands were what splintered the hard shell around me. So tiny, fingers splayed as he reached for my face. I cupped his tiny head and kissed his forehead. He quieted, his lips quivering. I wanted to pull him into my rib cage and hold him inside my body once more. I was staggered by him, my beautiful boy. "I need time with him," I whispered to no one in particular. I prayed they would grant me this one wish. Everyone in the room exchanged looks, but after the baby was cleaned and swaddled, he was placed in my arms once more. He stared at me with wide eyes. I kissed his cheeks, soft in the warmest shade of brown with a hint of red. "I didn't know," I said, holding him as tightly as I dared. "I didn't know I would love you." I saw nothing of his father and the boy. Not one single thing. It was a mercy. Melinda slipped out of the room. When the door opened again, it was Campbell who ran to my side. He looked at the baby, his eyes watery and wide open. He covered my hand with his. "I don't think I can let him go," I said, my voice cracking. "I'm sorry, I did not expect this. I didn't know. I don't know what to do." I started to cry, and then I was sobbing from somewhere deep, sobbing for the woman who had spent the past 9 months on a sticky floor in a hot sugar warehouse with strange, violent men. Campbell pushed the railing down and climbed into bed with me. His shoes fell loudly to the floor as he kicked them off. He wiped my tears as quickly as they fell. "You don't have to let him go," he said. I brushed my fingers across the baby's forehead. "I didn't know." The baby yawned and closed his eyes. I couldn't keep my eyes open. It was dark outside when I awoke. I was alone in my hospital room. I remembered the soft, warm weight of the baby against my chest. The absence was unbearable. I panicked, shot up, then winced. I pressed the call button, and a few minutes later, a tired-looking nurse padded into my room. "My baby," I croaked. "Did they take him? Is it too late?" The nurse smiled. "He's in the nursery. His father is with him. Wanted you to get some rest. They'll be back soon. New mothers can sleep with their babies if they want." The tight pain in my chest slowly began to unravel. "I want," I said. I sat up and stared at the door, the waiting interminable. When he returned, Campbell was pushing a bassinet, the baby swaddled in a blue blanket, wearing a little blue hat, fast asleep. "He was fussy," Campbell said. "We went to the nursery to hang out." He waved his wrist, showing off a hospital bracelet matching the baby's and mine. "They gave me one of these. I got to feed him with a tiny bottle the size of two of my fingers." My husband looked different, softer. His face couldn't contain his smile. He was giddy. "What about..." I notified the lawyer. They're disappointed, of course, but this was always a possibility. People in their situation know that. "I have done a terrible thing." "No, you haven't." I explained what I could. He pressed his fingers against the baby's forehead. "I know people," he said. "I'm going to do everything in my power to help them." The baby shifted slightly and made an adorable wet sound. "We're not ready for this. We have no idea what we're doing. We don't even have a car seat. We drive ridiculous cars. I'm sorry. You didn't sign up for this." "Stop apologizing. This is exactly what I signed up for." I began fiddling with my hospital bracelet. "You don't know. I want you to tell me." I pointed to the baby. "He can never know, Campbell. Never. Do you understand?" My husband nodded. I carefully got out of bed and went to the window. A dull ache throbbed between my thighs. "Don't look away," Campbell said. I ignored him. I thought I would never be able to love him right. I thought he would always be a reminder. I will never know who made him. I don't want to. I was taken to a sugar warehouse and thrown into a room with no furniture, the floor sticky with sweet grime. I couldn't think. I was terrified. It was unspeakably hot. I could hardly breathe. Hours later, a fat man with a shiny bald head appeared. He said the wife of a rich American was worth a lot of money. He told me to undress. I didn't know what to do. The man backhanded me. I looked into his eyes to try to make sense of the kind of man he was. I took too long. He backhanded me again and drove his fist into my stomach. My gut wrenched. I told him my husband would pay for me. He tore my clothes from my body and dragged me by my hair into a large room filled with a mountain of raw sugar that reached to the ceiling. He threw me down and the sugar scratched my bare skin. He unbuckled his pants. I begged. There was nowhere to run, men everywhere. He climbed on top of me, so heavy. I have never stopped feeling his wet skin against mine. Our bodies sank into that mountain of sugar. Grains of sugar floated in the air as he thrust. In the shafts of sunlight filling the warehouse, the sugar looked beautiful. So that's what I looked at. I couldn't close my eyes, no matter how hard I tried. Grains of sugar fell on my tongue as I screamed. The sugar beneath me hardened with my blood, and then there was another man and another, each crueler. When it was over, I balled myself into a corner to wait. By the end, I was wild and vicious, scratching and clawing at anything that came near me. After, they drove me to my father's house. Fabienne sat in the back of the truck with me. He said, "If only you had given me a little kiss, smiling like a spurned child." He tried to kiss me, fumbling at my body with his foolish hands. I snapped, screaming hoarsely as I clawed at his face, felt his skin come away. They had to stop the truck to pull us apart. As he got into the cab, he cursed me. I looked at my hands, red and raw, holding a piece of his skin. I slapped it against the cab window. He held his face as he turned around to stare at me. I never looked away. When I finished speaking, I turned back to Campbell. I did not want to look at my child and be forced to remember that. I did not want to love him less than he deserved. I did not want to hate him, which he did not deserve. Campbell knelt by the side of the bed. He took my hands, kissing them over and over. He didn't say anything useless. He didn't try to change what could not be changed. Campbell flies out to meet me. I wait on the sidewalk as a town car pulls up. Campbell Jr., CJ, bounds out of the car first, his arms thrust high in the air. I still don't see the men who force their way into me when I look at my son. I hope I never will. CJ jumps into my arms, and I clasp the back of his head. The curved bone fits perfectly in my palm. I can breathe again. I cover his face in kisses, and he giggles. He says, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy." Campbell tips the driver. I grab his shirt and pull him in. When he kisses me, I am home. "I never thought this day would come," Campbell said. I slide my hand into the pocket of his jeans, pulling him closer still. "I'm ready." Maria is startled when we walk into my aunt's house. "You have a son," she says, stuttering. Campbell is holding him now, our son drowsy from the long flight, his arms hanging limply at his sides. "I told you I did." She clears her throat. I don't know what she wants from me, who she wants me to be. She studies Campbell. In my mother tongue, she says, "You married an old man." I want to claw her eyes out. I hold Campbell's arm possessively. Finally, she says, "I must attend to your grandmother." As she walks away, Campbell elbows me. "I'm not that old. She has a big ass." That evening, I sit with my grandmother holding CJ in my lap, surrounded by the smell and joy of him. "Such a beautiful boy," she says. Her eyes are milky. I hold her hand, can feel the fragility of that network of bones. "I wanted you to know him." CJ claps his hands and sings a song I don't recognize. He loves to sing. Sometimes Campbell and I hear him on the baby monitor singing in his room. We laugh and laugh and laugh. "Do you want to give your great-grandmother a kiss?" I whisper into CJ's ear. He nods politely and leans in, leaving a loud, wet kiss on her cheek. He squirms out of my arms and runs away. "Campbell," I say loudly, "he's on his way to you." I hold my breath until I hear Campbell growl, and CJ growls back. It's this thing they do I don't pretend to understand. I can still feel my son in the room. Some part of him is always with me. My grandmother leans into me, says my aunt is stealing her money. I listen carefully. I take her seriously. She's not allowed to have money. She'll use it to bribe Maria to bring her cakes and other confections. She has always had a sweet tooth, and Maria is corruptible. My grandmother's tongue, like my son's, is awfully fond of sugar. Cheap, fast, filling. When Lucien arrives in the United States by way of Canada, an illegal but uneventful border crossing and hitching rides down to Miami, his cousin Christophe, who made his own way to Miami years earlier, hands him a $50 bill and tells Lucien to eat Hot Pockets until he gets a job because they are cheap, filling, and taste good. Lucien sleeps on the floor in an apartment he shares with five other men like him, all of them pretending this life is better than that which came before. There is a small kitchen with an electric stove that has two burners and a microwave that is rarely cleaned. Christophe tells Lucien that Hot Pockets are easy to prepare. Lucien is in the United States because he loves Miami Vice. He loves the shiny suits, tubs, and Crockett wear. He loves their swagger. He loves the idea of Miami as a perfect place where problems are always solved and there are beautiful women as far as a man can see. In Secondaire, Lucien would dream about Miami while the French nuns frowned and slapped his desk with their rulers. He has not yet seen that Miami, but he knows it is there. It has to be. Lucien's apartment is in Pembroke Pines, a world away from Little Haiti and everything that might be familiar in an unfamiliar place. Every morning he wakes up at 5, showers, gets dressed. He walks 4 miles to the Home Depot on Pines Boulevard, where he waits for contractors to cruise through the parking lot looking for cheap, fast labor. He stands in the immigrant bazaar with the Mexicans and Guatemalans and Nicaraguans, sometimes a few Chinese. They stand tall, try to look strong, hope that a long white finger will curl in their direction. 3 or 4 times a week, he is lucky. He grabs his tool belt, hauls himself into the truck bed, and enjoys the humid morning air as he is driven to big houses owned by white people, locked behind gates to keep their things safe from people like him, even though he has never stolen a thing in his life. Once a week, Lucien buys a calling card for $25. It will allow him to talk for 28 minutes. He calls home and talks to his mother, his uncle, his wife, his 4 children. He tells elaborate fables about his new life, how he's found them a new home with a bedroom for each child and air conditioning so they can breathe cool, dry air. There is a lawn with green grass and a swimming pool in the backyard by which his wife can lie in the sun. His children, 2 boys and 2 girls, all under the age of 10, clamor for his attention. He strains to understand them through the static on the line. They tell him about school and their friends and the UN soldier who is renting a room in the house, how he's teaching them Brazilian curse words. When there are only a few minutes left, his wife chases the children into the bedroom they all share. They are alone. There is no time for anything tender. She whispers that she needs Lucien to send more money. There's no food, there's no water. She wants to know when he will send for them. He lies. He tells her he's doing all he can. He says, soon. On the weekends, Christophe picks Lucien up in the truck his boss lets him take home, and they go to house parties in Little Haiti. They listen to compas and drink rum, as all Haitians are wont to do. They philosophize about how to solve their country's problems. Haiti, his father would always tell Lucien while he was growing up, is a country with 7 million dictators. Sometimes, when it is very late at night, Lucien will find comfort in the arms of a woman who is not his wife. He will go home with her, and in the darkness, as he cups her breasts with his hands and listens to her breathing against him, as he presses his lips against her neck and her shoulder, then licks the salt from her skin, he will imagine she tastes like home. Around the corner from Lucien's apartment is a 7-Eleven. Sometimes, when he can't sleep, Lucien likes to go there because it is cool and bright and clean, and he can buy Hot Pockets. The man who works there late at night is also Haitian. He understands why Lucien likes to walk slowly up and down each aisle, carefully studying each row filled with perfectly packaged products. When the clerk first arrived in Miami, he did the same thing. Lucien thinks about the sweet things he would buy for his children if they were with him, and how much it would please him to watch them eat a Twix or a Kit Kat. Each night before he leaves 7-Eleven, Lucien buys 2 Hot Pockets that he microwaves and a super big gulp. He walks home and sits on the curb in front of his building so he can be alone. He drinks slowly so there is no ice left in the cup when he is done. He eats one of the Hot Pockets and the other one he holds. He enjoys its warmth, thinks he's holding the whole of the world in his hands. In the manner of water or light. My mother was conceived in what would ever after be known as the Massacre River. The sharp smell of blood has followed her since. When she first moved to the United States, she read the dictionary from front to back. Her vocabulary quickly became extensive. Her favorite word is suffuse, to spread over or through in the manner of water or light. When she tries to explain how she is haunted by the smell of blood, she says that her senses are suffused with it. My grandmother knew my grandfather for less than a day. Everything I know about my family's history, I know in fragments. We are the keepers of secrets. We are secrets ourselves. We try to protect each other from the geography of so much sorrow. I don't know that we succeed. As a young woman, my grandmother worked on a sugarcane plantation in Dajabon, the first town across the border Haiti shares with the Dominican Republic. She lived in a shanty with 5 other women, all strangers, and slept on a straw mat beneath which she kept her rosary, a locket holding a picture of her parents, and a picture of Clark Gable. She spoke little Spanish, so she kept to herself. Her days were long, and beneath the bright sun, her skin burned ebony and her hair bleached white. When she walked back to her quarters at the end of each day, she heard the way people whispered and saw how they stared. They steered clear. They were terrified by the absence of light around and within her. They thought she was a demon. They called her La Demonia Negra. After saying her prayers, after dreaming of Port-au-Prince and lazy afternoons at the beach in the movie house where she watched Mutiny on the Bounty and It Happened One Night and Call of the Wild, after dreaming of the warmth of Clark Gable's embrace, my grandmother would tear her old dresses into long strips so she could better bind the cuts and scratches she'd earned from a long day in the cane fields. She would sleep a dreamless sleep, gathering the courage she would need to wake up the next morning. In a different time, she had been loved by two parents, had lived a good life. But then they died, and she was left with nothing, and like many Haitians, she crossed over into the Dominican Republic in the hope that there her luck would change. My grandfather worked at the same plantation. He was a hard worker. He was a tall, strong man. My grandmother, late at night when she cannot sleep, will sit with a glass of rum and coke and talk about how her hands remember thick ropes of muscle in his shoulders and thighs. His name was Jacques Bertrand. He wanted to be in the movies. He had a bright white smile that would have made him a star. My grandmother is also haunted by smells. She cannot stand the smell of anything sweet. If she smells sweetness in the air, she purses her lips and sucks on her teeth, shaking her head. Today, when we drive to our family's beach property in Maui, she closes her eyes. She can stand neither the sight of the cane fields nor that of the withered men and women hacking away at stubborn stalks of cane with dull machetes. When she sees the cane fields, a sharp pain radiates across her shoulders and down her back. Her body cannot forget the labors it has known. Now, the Massacre River is shallow enough to cross by foot. But in October 1937, the waters of what was called the Dajabon River ran strong and deep. The unrest had been going on for days. Dominican soldiers, determined to rid their country of the Haitian scourge, went from plantation to plantation in a murderous rage. My grandmother did the only thing she could, burning through a long day in the cane field, marking the time by the rise and fall of her machete blade. She prayed the trouble would pass her by. It was General Rafael Trujillo who ordered all the Haitians out of his country, who had his soldiers interrogate anyone whose skin was too dark, who looked like they belonged on the other side of the border. It was the general who took a page from the Book of Judges to exact his genocide and bring German industry to his island. Soldiers came to the plantation where my grandmother worked. They had guns. They were cruel, spoke in loud, angry voices, took liberties. One of the women with whom my grandmother shared her shanty betrayed my grandmother's hiding place. We never speak of what happened after that. The ugly details are trapped between the fragments of our family history. We are secrets ourselves. My grandmother ended up in the river. She found a shallow place. She tried to hold her breath while she hid from the marauding soldiers on both of the muddy shores straddling the river. There was a moment when she lay on her back and submerged herself until her entire body was covered by water, until her pores were suffused with it. She didn't come up for air until the ringing in her ears became unbearable. The moon was high and the night was cold. She smelled blood in the water. She wore only a thin dress plastered to her skin. Her feet were bare. When a bloated corpse slowly floated past her, then an arm, a leg, something she couldn't recognize, she covered her mouth with her hand. She screamed into her own skin instead of the emptiness around her. Jacques Bertrand, who worked hard and wanted to be in the movies, found his way to the river that ran strong and deep. He moved himself through the water until he found my grandmother. He tapped her on the shoulder, and instead of turning away, she turned into him, opened that part of herself not yet numb with terror. She found comfort in the fear mirrored in his eyes. His chest was bare, and she pressed her damp cheek against his breastbone. She slowed her breathing to match his. She listened to the beat of his heart. It echoed beneath the bones of his ribcage. "An angel," she told me. I thought he was an angel who had come to deliver me from that dark and terrible place. My grandparents bound their bodies together as their skin gathered in tiny folds, as their bodies shook violently. Jacques Bertrand, who worked hard, who wanted to be in the movies, wrapped his arms around my grandmother. In a stuttered whisper, he told her the story of his life. "I want to be remembered," he said. She cupped his face in her hands, traced his strong chin with her thumbs, and brushed her lips across his. She followed the bridges of scar tissue across his back with her fingertips. She said, "You will be remembered." She told him the story of her own life. She asked him to remember her, too. My grandmother still hears the dying screams from that night. She remembers the dull, wet sound of machetes hacking through flesh and bone. The only thing that muted those horrors was a man she knew but did not know who wore bridges of scar across his back. I do not know the intimate details, but my mother was conceived. In the morning, surrounded by the smell and silence of death, my grandparents crawled out of the river that had, overnight, become a watery coffin holding 25,000 bodies. The Massacre River had earned its name. The two of them, soaking wet, their bodies stiff and on the verge of fever, crawled into Wanamet. They were home. They were far from home. My grandmother laced her fingers with my grandfather's, and they sought refuge in an abandoned church. They fell to their knees and prayed, and then their prayers became something else, something like solace. When night fell again, the Dominican soldiers crossed into Wanamet, into a place they did not belong. My grandfather was killed. He saved my grandmother's life by confronting three soldiers, creating a window through which my grandmother could escape. Jacques Bertrand died wanting to be remembered, so my grandmother stayed in that place of such sorrow, took a job cooking and cleaning for the headmaster of a primary school. At night, she slept in an empty classroom. She gave birth to my mother and later married the headmaster, who raised my mother as his own. At night, my grandmother took my mother to the river and told her the story of how she came to be. My grandmother knelt on the riverbank, her bones sinking in the mud as she brought handfuls of water to her mouth. She drank the memories in that water. When my mother turned 12, she, my grandmother, and the headmaster moved to Port-au-Prince. The school had closed and the headmaster took a new appointment in the capital. At first, my grandmother refused to leave her memories, but the headmaster put his foot down. She was his wife. She would follow. My mother recalls how her mother wailed, her voice pitched sharp and thin, cutting everything around her. In the front yard of their modest home, a large coconut tree fell, its wide trunk split neatly in half. The fallen fruit rotted instantly. My grandmother went to the Massacre River, her long white hair gathered around her face. She took river mud into her hands, eating it, enduring the thick, bitter taste. When my mother and the headmaster found her, my grandmother was lying in a shallow place, shivering beneath a high moon, her face caked with dry mud. In the capital, my grandmother was a different woman, quieted. The headmaster consulted Catholic missionaries, Hungans and Mambos, in case she had been possessed by a loi or spirit and needed healing. Finally, he resigned himself to living with her ghosts. He loved her as best a man whose wife loves another man can. He focused on my mother's education and waited. Sometimes the headmaster asked my mother if she was happy. She said, "My mother does love you." It wasn't until the day my mother left Port-au-Prince that my grandmother became herself again. I've been told that the headmaster and my grandmother stood on the tarmac, white with heat, the air billowing around them in visible waves. My mother kissed her mother twice on each cheek. She kissed the headmaster. She turned and headed for the staircase to board the plane, a heavy wind blowing her skirt wildly. My grandmother didn't run after her only child, but she did say, "Ticur, little heart." My mother stopped. She didn't turn around. My mother is a small, nervous woman. Her life began, she says, the day she got off the Pan Am flight from Port-au-Prince in New York City. She sat in the back of a yellow taxicab driven by a man who spoke a language she did not understand. She stared out the dirty window and up at the tall steel buildings. She was 21. My mother found an apartment in the Bronx. She took a job as a seamstress for Perry Ellis, making clothes she loved but could not afford. She learned to speak English by reading the dictionary and watching American television. Once a month, she wrote her mother and the only father she knew a long letter telling them about America, begging them to join her. My grandmother always wrote back but refused to leave Haiti. She would not leave the ghost of a man who could not be forgotten. My mother went to doctor after doctor trying to find someone who would free her from a sharp smell of blood that has always suffused her senses. Each doctor assured my mother it was all in her head. She took the subway to Chinatown and tried acupuncture. The acupuncturist carefully inserted needles into the webs of her thumbs and along her body's meridians. As he placed each needle, he shook his head. He said, "There are some things no medicine can fix." When I asked my mother how she met my father, she said, "I wasn't going to marry a Haitian man." She rarely answers the question she is asked. My father is an ear, nose, and throat specialist. He is the last doctor my mother consulted. When she told him she could only smell blood, he believed her. He tried to help her, and when he couldn't, he asked her to join him for dinner. Eventually, he asked for her hand in marriage. She didn't say yes. She told my father she would never return to Haiti, that he would have to accept that her life began a year earlier. She was a seamstress whose senses were suffused with the smell of blood, who didn't know her father and couldn't understand her mother. They were married in a Manhattan synagogue 9 months after they met. My parents remained childless for many years, but never discussed the matter. If my mother was asked when she would start a family, she would say, "I am very much in love with my husband." When she learned she was pregnant with me at the age of 40, it was a hot July afternoon in New York, 1978. She ran out onto the street, threw her hands in the air, stared into the incandescent sun. She cried as the light spread over her. A joyful sound vibrated from her throat, through her mouth, and into the city around her. She went to my father's office and told him the news. He cried too. When I was born, I was crying lustily. We are a family unafraid of our tears. My mother has never been able to accept she will never know her real father. She worries her mother has woven the story of her conception into an elaborate fable to hide a darker truth. My mother has an imagination. She knows too much about what angry, wild soldiers will do to frightened, fleeing young women. My mother looks in the mirror and cannot recognize herself. She sees only the face of a man she can never know. When I was a little girl and we sat together at the dinner table, my mother often stared into the distance, grinding her teeth. My father would take her hand and say, "Jacqueline, please stop worrying." She never did. She was the keeper of her mother's secrets. She was a secret herself. Every summer, once I turned 5, my parents took me to JFK and sent me to my grandmother for 3 months. I was dispatched to do the work of a dutiful daughter in my mother's absence. My grandmother and the man I know as my grandfather, the headmaster who took in a scared young woman whose skin had burned ebony, whose hair had bleached white, who bore a child with no father, they were kind to me. I brought them pictures of my parents and money my mother carefully stuffed in my shoes. I brought cooking oil and pantyhose, a VCR and videotapes, gossip magazines, cornflakes. I knew never to bring anything sweet. My grandmother kept her promise to Jacques Bertrand. Each time she saw me, she offered new fragments of their story, or, if my mother's fears were correct, the story she needed us to believe. I looked like him, had his eyes and his chin. Like my parents, my grandmother and the headmaster doted on me. When I returned to the States at the end of each August, I would try to ask my mother questions to better piece things together, but she would only shut herself in her room, rub perfume across her upper lip, lie on her back, her eyes covered with a cool washcloth. When I was 13, the headmaster drove my grandmother and me to their beach property in Moree for the afternoon. Just before leaving New York for the summer, I had celebrated my bat mitzvah. The three of us sang along to Compas and the adults listened to me chattering from the back seat. It was a good day. I longed for my mother to know there was so much joy to be found in the country of her birth. As we pulled into a gas station, beggars suddenly swarmed our car, a throbbing mass of dark, shiny faces and limbs needing more than we could possibly give. There was a man with one leg and one old wooden crutch. His face was disfigured by a bulging tumor beneath his left eye. He planted his hands against the glass of the window, leering at me, the skin over the tumor rippling with his anger. It was the first time I understood the land of my mother's birth as a place run through with pain. Each time I returned to New York in the comforts of home, I brought pictures and long letters and special spices, these affections, mother by proxy. My mother always took me for lunch alone at the Russian tea room the day following my return. She had me recount my trip in exhaustive detail, inhaling from a perfume-scented handkerchief every few minutes, carefully probing so as to get the clearest sense of how her mother was doing. Once in a while, I forgot myself and asked my mother why she didn't just go to Haiti to find out for herself. In those moments, she gave me a stern look. She said, "It is not easy to be a good daughter." When I turned 16, I went to summer camp in western Massachusetts because I was young and silly. I wanted to do normal things. Haiti was too much work. I was tired of the heat and the smells and the inescapable poverty, how my sweaty limbs caught in mosquito netting, how I had to go to the well for water when the cistern wasn't working. I was sick of the loud hum of generators and tiny lizards clinging to the window screens, and the way everyone stared at me and called me la mulatte. Summer camp was a largely disappointing experience. I was a city girl, and the Berkshires were far too rural for me. I wasn't any kind of Jewish the other girls at the camp could understand. I spent the summer sitting on the lakeshore reading, lamenting that I could have been at a real beach in the Caribbean with people who loved me and looked like me. It would be 10 years before I returned to Haiti. The next summer, my father took me to Tel Aviv. He showed me the apartment where he grew up in Ramat Aviv. He showed me his parents' graves, told me how much they would have loved me. I saw all kinds of people who did indeed look like me, who didn't laugh at my stuttered Hebrew. We spent a week on a kibbutz, my father in his linen shirt and shorts, tanned, laughing, home. I felt a real sadness for my mother, who couldn't take such joy in the land of her birth. We went to the beach. We went to Jaffa and looked toward the sea and Andromeda's rock. We cried at the Wailing Wall. I understood Haiti was not the only place in the world run through with pain. The year after I graduated from law school, the headmaster died. I called my grandmother to ask how she was doing. She said, "I have been a good wife." She was ready to return to Jacques Bertrand. I told my mother we had to go see her mother. She was lying on her bed, rubbing perfume across her upper lip. She had not taken the news of the headmaster's death well. He was the only father she ever knew. She turned to me and said, "This is my home, where I am needed." I said, "You are needed elsewhere," and she waved a hand limply, conceding the point. My father prescribed my mother some Valium, and the three of us flew to Port-au-Prince. By the time we landed, my mother was sufficiently sedated. As we disembarked and walked into the terminal, she dreamily asked, "Are we there?" My grandmother and her driver were waiting for us. I inhaled sharply as I saw her for the first time in a decade. She was impossibly small, a frail figure, her dark flesh much looser now, her features hollowed, her white hair swept atop her head in a loose bun. She and my mother stood inches apart and stared at each other. My grandmother took her daughter's face in her hands, nodded. That night in our hotel, I heard my mother whisper to my father that she could hardly breathe but for the smell of blood. After we had spent a few days in the capital, helping my grandmother settle her affairs and visiting the headmaster's grave, she was ready to return to Jacques Bertrand. Despite our demand she stay in the capital or return to the States with us, my grandmother was resolute. We drove across the country to Wanamet on the only passable road. It took hours, and by the time we arrived, we were all tired, sweaty, sore, and irritable. Wanamet was not the city it had once been. It was a sad, hopeless place, crumbling buildings everywhere, paint peeling from billboards, the streets crowded with people, each person wanting and needing more than the last. Most of the roads had gone to mud from recent flooding. The air was stifling and pressed down on us uncomfortably. As we stood in the courtyard in front of a small concrete house my grandmother had purchased, men hanging from a passing tap-tap leered at us. My father stood in front of me, glaring. My mother rubbed her forehead and asked my father for another Valium. My mother and her mother kept to themselves for the first few days, huddled together, trying to make up for nearly 30 years of separation. There was no room for my father and me and what they needed from one another. On the second night, I went to a local bar where everyone stared as I took a seat. I drank watery rum and coke until my face and boredom felt numb. I danced to Usher with a man named Innocent. When I sneaked back to my grandmother's house, I found her sitting in the dark. She nodded to me but said nothing. On the third night, the moon was high and bright, casting its pale light over and through everything. I lay beneath mosquito netting in a tank top and boxers, one arm over my head, one arm across my stomach, my body feeling open and loose. I listened to the sounds of everyone else sleeping. I tried to understand the what and why of where we were. Just as I was on the verge of drifting asleep, I heard a scratching at the door and sat up, pulling the sheets around me. My grandmother appeared in the doorway. She curled her bent fingers, beckoning. Slowly, I stretched myself out of bed, pulled on a pair of jeans and flip-flops. I found my grandmother by the front door. My mother was standing next to her, fidgeting, shifting from one foot to the other, clutching at her perfume-scented handkerchief. "What's wrong?" I asked. My grandmother smiled in the darkness. "Come with us," she said. We walked nearly a mile to the banks of the Massacre River, my grandmother pressing her hand against the small of my mother's back. In the distance, we could see soldiers keeping watch at the checkpoint, their cigarettes punctuating the darkness. I heard hundreds of frightened people who looked like me splashing through the water, searching for safety, and then silence. My grandmother climbed down the damp, steep riverbank, my mother warning her mother to be careful. She waved for us to join her. I slipped out of my sandals, took my mother's hand, helped her into the river. We stood in a shallow place. I curled my toes in the silt of the riverbed and shivered. I had pictured the river as a wide, yawning, and bloody beast, but where we stood, the river flowed weakly. The waters did not run deep. It was just a border between two geographies of grief. My grandmother pointed down. The hem of her dressing gown floated around her. "Here," she said softly. My mother's shoulders shook, but she made no sound. She gripped my arm. "I cannot breathe," she said. Then she dropped to her knees, curled into herself. She said, "I must know the truth." I knelt behind her. I held her, tried to understand her. I said, "You can breathe." My grandmother said, "You know the only truth that matters." Again, I heard hundreds of frightened people splashing through the water, keening, reaching for something that could never be reached. The ground beneath us trembled from the heavy footsteps of roving soldiers. I smelled their sweat and their confused, aimless anger. We knelt there for a long while. My grandmother stood, whispering the story of how she came to know and remember Jacques Bertrand until her words dried on her lips. I stroked my mother's hair gently, waited for her breathing to slow, her back rising into my chest with a melancholy cadence. We mourned until morning. The sun rose high. Bright beams of light spread over and through us. The sun burned so hot it dried the river itself, turned the water into light. We were left kneeling in a bed of sand and bones. I started crying. I could not stop. I cried to wash us all clean. Lacrimosa. Maryse thought she knew things about tears. When she was a little girl in Port-au-Prince, her father would listen to Mozart's Requiem while their neighbors danced to compas and American rock and roll and R&B. Their small two-room home would fill with the melancholy of earnest choral voices and string instruments. Whenever the Lacrimosa sequence began, her father would close his eyes and hold a hand high in the air. Everyone would still. The music was so beautiful, Maryse knew she was feeling everything that could ever be felt. Then the government was overthrown again and again and again, and mouths grew hungry, and an even thicker maze of wires began stretching from house to house, each family stealing power from here and there. Walking down alleys, you could no longer see the sky, and then it was time for the generators, with their loud, angry hum, making everything thick with the smell of diesel. Her father put the turntable away. There was nothing left to feel. When the UN soldier first came to her door with his brown skin and baby blue bulletproof vest, he said his name was Carlos Rocha from Veli Vela, Brazil. He held his helmet in the crook of his arm, his long rifle slung over his shoulder. Fat beads of sweat rolled down his face. He had money, a slow, lazy grin, and curly black hair. He smiled at her only child. Carlos Rocha gently squeezed the boy's cheeks between the calluses of his soldier hands. He asked if she cooked, what she charged for her spare room. His grin widened, revealing dimples. She smiled back, nervous, named her price. Everything in Port-au-Prince had a price. The soldier moved in. Every night he returned to Maryse's well-kept home, complained about the heat, the heavy air, the trash everywhere, the dark, shiny people throwing rocks and bottles and angry words. He ate her food. He shared her bed, touched her body with his soldier hands. He filled her and frightened her, and she felt something she didn't understand. She learned about lacrimatory agents, how chemical compounds were designed for the express purpose of stimulating the corneal nerves to draw tears and inflict pain. He told her how his unit was once locked in a bunker filled with tear gas. The soldiers tried not to breathe or cry, the jowls of their cheeks quivering uncontrollably until their chests threatened to explode, and finally they sobbed, not because of the burning in their eyes, nose, and throat, but because of the frailty of feeling everything at once. Maryse sang songs to comfort the soldier after his long days patrolling dark, dangerous places. She learned his words, he learned hers. She worried. It did not take long for Maryse to forget that Carlos Rocha was a man on a mission. He was far from his home. He would not stay. The warmth of her body, the way she welcomed him inside her, the taste of her skin, were all things he would walk away from. He kept a well-oiled gun beneath her bed, carried it every day, and once in a while he shot, he fired, he hurt, he killed. She forgot all this until one day her boy sat in front of their small concrete home, tears streaming down his face as he stacked spent tear gas canisters as high as his little arms could reach. When the boy felt his mother's shadow over him, he looked up with his bright, shining eyes, holding a canister in each chubby fist. He said, "Look, Mama, I made." She remembered what was and what would not be. She pulled her child into her arms. She felt nothing but the bitterness of her son's tears on her tongue. The Harder They Come. We were told a lot of things about the Americans. They want our skin bronze and our teeth white and gleaming and our shirts cut low. The Americans want us to be impressed by the size of their cruise ship and other such things. The Americans want us to speak English, but not too well. The Americans want us to smile and flatter. Every week we stand perfectly groomed in a perfect line. We watch as the cruise ship slowly pulls into port. Before long, the pier fills with the Americans, some pale, some tan, mostly large and red-faced. The women wear ill-fitting bikinis and wraps and sundresses. The men wear Hawaiian shirts and board shorts and khaki shorts and tank tops. Their faces are covered with large black sunglasses. They talk loudly. They walk slowly. As they near us, they look up at the large sign that reads, "Welcome to La Badie." They see us and say, "The local color here is just so pretty." We serve them drinks and local foods and sell them handmade crafts from local artisans that arrived on another boat from China. The Americans rent jet skis and shout to each other as they bounce over waves. Their skin bronzes and burns. The Americans are happy. They drink and drink and drink and get louder and happier. They ask us to take their pictures and they point their cameras at us so when they return home, they can have friends over for wine to show off all the dangerous places they have been. The Americans apply suntan lotion and bathe in the sun, stretching their bodies on striped chaise lounges, and as they bake, they fill the air with the sickly sweet smell of coconut oil. They listen to music and read glossy magazines and try to decide what they want for dinner back on the boat and complain about the thick, humid air. They say they quite like this Haiti, so clean and calm, so pleasant, not at all like on CNN. The Americans ask questions but rarely listen to the answers. Beyond the pier and the heat of the white sand beach, with the striped chaise lounges and the thatched huts with brightly colored roofs, there is a thick line of lush palm trees. And behind the lush palm trees is a very tall fence with barbed wire separating this Haiti from that Haiti. The Americans never ask to see that Haiti. The Americans know that Haiti is there. The Americans, the men, they like us and want us. They think we too are for sale as part of the Hispaniola experience. They offer us their American dollars and expect us to be impressed by the likeness of Andrew Jackson. We prefer the countenance of Benjamin Franklin. The Americans grab our asses and whisper in our ears, leaving their hot, boozy breath on our skin. The less original among them say things like, "Voulez-vous coucher avec moi?" in heavy, awkward French, over-enunciating each word. Some of us are indeed for sale, or want to know what it would be like to be with a man with such pale skin, or we are bored, or we just don't care. We tell the Americans to follow us. We walk down the hot sandy beach slowly, shaking our hips, and they ogle us, and they say vulgar things we pretend not to hear. We walk until we can no longer see the pier, can no longer hear the laughter, or the sharp hum of jet skis, or the haggling for local crafts. We sneak behind a rocky embankment, or a small thicket of palm trees, or a deserted section of shaded beach. The men, the Americans, they don't fill our heads with romantic ideas. There are no tender moments. The Americans bite our bare shoulders and squeeze our brown breasts in their meaty hands. They groan as they tell us to get on our knees, take them in our mouths. They ask us if we like it. We pretend not to speak English. We whisper silly things in French. We try not to laugh, which sounds like a moan, and that the Americans adore. They fuck us from behind with our hands and cheeks pressed against the burning rocks. They fuck us behind the market or against the fence, beyond the thick line of lush palm trees. They never take long. They never say thank you. The Americans, however, always come. All things being relative. The copper country of Michigan's Upper Peninsula is a forgotten place. The land is vast and densely forested, filled with ghosts and skeletons wandering through the industrial ruin. In the summer, the UP is breathtaking and irresistible. In the winter, blanketed by snow upon snow, ice and sand, the UP is unforgiving, inhospitable, inescapable. Copper once reigned. There were mines rich with ore and men ready, willing, able to pull that bounty from the earth. The mine owners prospered. They built grand homes atop hills, had buildings named after them. The men who worked for these mine owners did not prosper as much, but they owned homes of their own and they fed their families, and on Sundays they went to church to thank the God who provided all good gifts. Progress is not kind, and human nature cannot resist the lure of possibility. Where once it was man who pulled the copper from the enriched soil of the Upper Peninsula, then it was machine, and then there was no need for any of it, and then there was nothing left. There is a beauty to be found in an abandoned mine. There is also a profound sadness. Stone walls decaying into awkward angles, machines rusted in motion, grasses grown wild, encroaching on all things. Old houses, haunted by miners with nothing to mine, don't fade away. They fall. They slump to their knees. They bow their heads. We get the news here in Upper Michigan, the frenzied accounts of recessions and depressions and unemployment. Things have changed, we're told. It's a new world and a new economy. People are hungry, tired, sick, poor. There is no respite, no way to satisfy our hunger or rejuvenate our spirits, heal our wounds, or change our fortunes. We laugh bitterly. This is not news. My parents were born in Haiti, the first free black nation in the world. It is an island of contradictions. The sand is always warm. The water is so clear blue bright that it is sometimes painful to behold. The art and music are rich, textured, revelatory, ecstatic. The sugarcane is raw and sweet. And yet, what most people think they know is this. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Her people eat mud cakes. There is no infrastructure, no sewer system, no reliable roads, erratic electricity. Women are not safe. Disease cannot be cured. Violence cannot be quelled. The land is eroding. The sky is falling. Freedom, it seems, has a price. We are defined by what we are not and what we do not have. We get American news in Haiti, too, via CNN, beamed down from satellites. We hear about these recessions and depressions, the unemployment, how things have changed. In the background, we listen to the grinding hum of the generator. Perhaps in the distance, gunshots as UN peacekeepers and roving gangs skirmish. We laugh. We marvel at such good news. The bitter taste burns. Gracias, Nicaragua, y lo sentimos. Nicaragüenses, nosotros haitianos lo sentimos, pero no queremos más el título del país más pobre en el hemisferio occidental. Le damos las gracias. El deshonor ahora es el suyo. You should know this. Every news story ever written or aired in perpetuity, whether on Euronews, Univision, ESPN or ABC, CNN, CBS, Fox or NBC, will begin and end referring to your beloved land as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. You are what you have not. You will hear these words until you are sick to your stomach, until you no longer recognize su tierra, until you start to believe the news stories are true, that nothing else matters, that si no puedes comprar cosas que no necesitas, tú no existes, tú no cuentas, tú no mereces respeto. It won't matter if the story is about Nicaraguan art, or the food, the music, or your people. It could be a story about wages or natural disasters, unrest in the countryside, the latest telenovela, or escándalo político. Por ejemplo, a blonde American reporter could be interviewing a famous Nicaraguan children's author. Her very first question undoubtedly will be, "What's it like coming from the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere?" Just know, the poor author will be left standing with her brightly illustrated book, full of ideas, vim and vigor, eager to discuss historias para los niños, and instead she will have to call upon the political science class she slept through in college to make do in her new role as political correspondent. At least, in hearing this, you know what to expect. You might also take comfort and el conocimiento that it likely won't take long for Haiti to regain her place. El deshonor siempre ha sido nuestro. The dirt we do not eat. Once or twice a month, Elsa in Cap Haitien receives a letter from her cousin Sarah in Miami. The letter is thick with news and U.S. dollars and promises of a better life, a better place, a better time, better things. "I wish you could see South Beach," Sarah writes. "The men are more beautiful than the women. They all wear makeup and fine clothes. The beach is not like home. It is crowded. It is dirty. After work, my friends and I, we run along the water barefoot. We drink straight from bottles of wine. We eat McDonald's and other good food that is also bad. They put so much salt on the French fries, for hours you can suck the grains from your fingers, feel them on your lips." Elsa saves these letters in a tin box she keeps beneath the narrow bed she shares with her boyfriend, who she pretends is her husband, even though he has another woman on the side. "My dearest cousin," Elsa writes back, "South Beach sounds like a dream. I have never tasted wine, but worry not, we still have our rum. You should know Christian is up to his old tricks. He won't work, he won't stay, and yet he does not leave. I think of you often. I wait for you to steal me away." Elsa misses Sarah. She does. She hates Sarah. She does. She hates the letters, the news, the promises, the lies. She hates hearing about air conditioning and water always running cold, safe to drink from the faucet, and TV shows about strippers and millionaires and more. "Is it true Haitians are eating mud pie?" Sarah wants to know. "Has it been so long since I've been home that the land itself sustains us? Last night I ate Dairy Queen. The ice cream reminded me of the poem we read when we were in secondaire about plums in the icebox, so cold and so sweet. I will never be able to enjoy another treat if it is true that all we have left is the ground at our feet, wet with water, a little salt, squeezed between our hands, baked in the hot sun, dried. dry in our mouths. Those left behind have heard these stories on Euronews and on Radio Metropole because one eager journalist saw what he wanted to see, saw an old woman at the side of the road squatting over her pies, her bare knees peeking out from the folds of her skirt. "Ma chère cousine," writes Elsa,